From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
Based on what he said about the vaccine rollout, I don't think Scott Morrison knows a race when he sees one, but I'm pretty glad our Olympians do. Australia's performance thus far in Tokyo has been the big story of the week, with the Aussie team already nabbing 9 gold medals in a haul so far of 21 medals. To put that in perspective, 8 gold medals is all we won in total for the whole of the Rio Games in 2016. And this gold rush has produced some new superstars like Ariane Titmus and reaffirmed the star status of others like Jessica Fox. But whether they've medalled or not, the Aussies in Tokyo have exemplified everything we want to see in our sporting heroes. But while Jess Fox has dominated in the canoeing, closer to home, Gladys Berejiklian has found herself up shit creek without a paddle. New South Wales cracked the 200 daily COVID case mark this week, and the plan now is to send in the army to enforce tougher lockdown measures. Forget about Gladys's famous gold standard contact traces, this is a gold medal winning failure. And it's a failure that experts think will drag on for months to come, long after the joy of this Olympics is a distant memory. Coming up on the show, we'll speak to Shervo himself and get the latest on the Olympic Games. Plus, it's Friday and that means the one and only Jeff Parry is on deck to talk politics. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio, Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, mate.
Mate, how are you going? How's that bottle of red before the show going for you?
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
I'm only joking.
You know, I had my COVID jab, first COVID jab yesterday.
Oh, this is why. And how did it go?
It went well. Like, I have to say, I wasn't in and out like 15 minutes or 20-odd minutes like you were. I was probably there for 45 minutes, including the 15-minute wait time,
well, that's
which
pretty
is pretty good.
I wouldn't be complaining at that. That's great.
But I owe you an apology as well. You remember yesterday when I was paying you out on that, monstrosity of a wallet that I see sitting right there on the desk, which is about 3 inches thick. And I bragged about, not carrying around a wallet.
Oh.
Do you know what you need when you get your vaccination?
Your Medicare card.
Yeah. So, of course, I did not have that.
Oh, what happened? Obviously,
they let me in anyway.
They let you through.
So, yeah, so there you go.
So, any side effects?
No, so far. Arm feels good.
Sorry, I didn't even ask if I can go into your medical information.
Yeah, no, go for it.
No, it was fine.
No, feeling tip top.
Wow.
So wait to see how the next one goes.
Oh, so you'll cop it on the second one then.
Yeah.
No, I'm only joking.
And now, let's talk McGowan in New South Wales. Mm. I mentioned Gladys Berejiklian, and McGowan's not happy.
McGowan is not happy. He's accused the New South Wales government, and let's face it, when he says the New South Wales government, he means Gladys, of being arrogant for refusing to learn from other states like us here in WA, which have been able to crush and kill the Delta variant of COVID. So New South Wales yesterday recorded 239 new cases, a record high, their worst day since the pandemic began. This is sure to be a hot topic at National Cabinet today where, awkward, Mark McGowan and Gladys Berejiklian will be looking at each other. Mark McGowan has said, look, the latest tightening of restrictions over in New South Wales doesn't go far enough. We need harsher restrictions. Over there, the army's being brought in to try to help police the restrictions and try to get a handle on these case numbers, which are just going up and up and up, it seems, despite the fact that the restrictions have been in place. Now, whether all people are abiding by these restrictions, that's another thing, hence why perhaps the army has been brought in to show how serious this is.
Yeah, yeah, it's a real crazy sign that that's what's necessary to get people to do the right thing, to
look
protect
at places
themselves.
Like WA and South Australia, very compliant, it's a different attitude. But this is no surprise that in New South Wales, they've been sold on this, we can live with the virus type of line. We can contact trace, we can isolate limited areas, limited inconvenience. Whereas we have been somehow conditioned to fear the bejesus out of this thing. And so, you know, when Daddy McGowan says stay at home, we stay at home.
Exactly.
He says put on a mask, we put on a mask.
Exactly.
You know, Gladys says, oh, look, I'm not sure if you are essential or not essential. You know, is there any surprise that they're having some dramas?
And it's also different from one area to the next. So some suburbs are in full lockdown, some suburbs are in half lockdown, and people travel between them all.
Some suburbs can have a single buddy, some suburbs can't have a single buddy. A single buddy can come from here, but they can't come from there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're going to invent a bloody Tinder for their COVID single buddy system there. Oh, are you from that local government area or this one? Yes, you're available. No, you're not available.
Well, it's like they've tried as hard as they can not to do a lockdown. And as a result, well, we're seeing the result. It's terrible. We'll wait and see. I spoke to a couple of medical experts yesterday and, you know, they think it's going to be months.
I reckon Christmas until we would even look at perhaps opening the border. That's my guess. The jelly bean jar guess, let's say Christmas.
Well, even if they'll think they're doing great if they get down to 10 or 15 new cases a day. But there's no way McGowan's going to open the borders if there's 10 or 15 cases.
No. Hasn't our thing been it needs to be zero cases for 28 days? I mean, I think there have been cases where the rules have been relaxed slightly. But we're still not open to South Australia. There's still people from WA who were in South Australia have come back and are in home quarantine, even though there've been no new cases in South Australia that have popped up and they've tested negative and the like. So, you know, we're much more heavy-handed here.
And how about the weather, eh? You almost got blown away on the way into work this morning like I did.
Whoa, hang on a minute, though. No severe weather warning for Perth. Not one weather warning. Trees down, power poles down.
It's hanging over Willerton from yesterday. Yesterday's warning still applies.
Well, there was a severe weather warning for further south, but for some reason we seem to have copped it in Perth and we weren't even really paying attention to this other than the fact of when I went to bed last night, I thought, geez, that rain sounds like it's coming in sort of more on a horizontal level than a vertical level. So, yes, the winds were very, very strong. Power crews have been out there this morning trying to restore power because power lines have been brought down across the place. We are in for more wet and stormy weather basically until next Wednesday. Mark that in your calendar. Next Wednesday is the first day of partly cloudy, and Thursday, breaking news, there is a sunny icon.
Hang on. No clouds, no partly cloudy.
No partly cloudy, no little bit of cloud, just all sun next Thursday.
Get your speedos out.
Do you want me to check the temperature?
The temperature, I bet it's cold.
Well, it's probably going to be in the teens, I would guess, because there's going to be no cloud cover. 20.
A 20. Great. Oh, that's all right.
That's all right.
I'd go to the beach.
A low of 8 degrees.
That's a bit cold. Maybe not an early morning swim.
It's not going to look too impressive. No, that cold.
Let's move on. Talking about things that aren't impressive, and I know a lot of people aren't impressed that this person who we spoke about yesterday, who was bitten by a lemon shark, has turned out to be a guy who in the past has proclaimed himself to be a shark rider.
Shark rider. Yeah. I know. Has he got that on his business card?
It's like Knight Rider, except sharks don't talk, they bite.
Well, he's under investigation now for provoking this 3.5-metre lemon shark, which we're told are quite prevalent in WA.
Reasonably common. That's what an expert told me yesterday.
We just haven't been told about it. So he was bitten off Varanus Island. The 32-year-old was the skipper in charge of this charter vessel. Isn't that awkward? Hang on a minute. You're meant to be, you know, behind the motor of this boat. So it had to race back to port so he could get medical attention. He was obviously flown back to Perth. His name's Aaron Moyer. He jumped off a boat onto the back of a 3-metre hammerhead back in 2014. This time it didn't work so well for him, obviously, and his passengers had to administer first aid. They say his stunt has ruined their trip, which had been 18 months in the planning. They paid about $5,000. They want compensation.
Fair enough, too. Yes. And lemon sharks, from what I understand, are not typically that aggressive.
Not if you're not jumping on the back of them, no.
Because that's the thing. I reckon if you go into any pub around Perth and try and jump on the back of somebody, they're probably going to take a swing at you as well.
Yeah. I mean, what an idiot.
Yeah. I think there's no other way to say it.
But think about the resources that have been wasted. Yep. The Royal Flying Doctor Service, the medical resources. Yep. If only he didn't jump on the back of that shark. Our taxpayer money goes towards that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Unless, I guess, with this investigation, if they find that, you know, it is the result of some sort of stupidity, maybe they can recover costs in that situation.
Well, maybe they should.
Yeah. Are there laws? I mean, there must be laws against jumping on a shark,
surely.
There
must be something.
You can't go around doing that. So stupid.
What's going on?
Yeah,
I know. I just feel for the poor people that were on this charter. 18 months in the planning, they probably thought, oh, so lucky, Perth and Peel are not locked down. We can go on our trip. And next minute, a bloke's jumping on a lemon shark.
Mate, what are you up to this weekend?
What have I got? I've got a party tomorrow night, a ski-themed party. Everyone's having ski-themed parties at the moment, I'm noticing. I had a Christmas in July thing last weekend. It's all very cold-themed, which is on brand for Perth at the moment.
I don't know if you've noticed the weather.
It's winter. I can't wait for summer, though. I think it's still more than 100 days away. Maybe we should focus on spring rather than summer.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic.
What about you? Anything exciting?
Let's see. So, I've got my daughter's netball game tonight, so I'm going. Hopefully, ooh, the hail stays away
in Tokyo?
From that. No, you know, yeah. Well, look, it might as well be. That's how excited the parents get.
Where's the netball game on at?
Matthews Netball Centre.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So it'll be windy.
And
windy
what
there.
About over the weekend?
Over the weekend, some stuff around the house. So,
oh, yeah, trip to Bunnings?
Yeah, cleaning up all the mess from the month of storms. Yeah, yeah. So a bit of that going on.
There's probably a fair bit in the gutters.
Yep.
You know what it's like? Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, like
you
your
know,
attitude.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take that attitude to the weekend. Yeah. Matt Tinney, thank you so much for all your work on The West Live today. We'll talk to you on Monday.
You have a great one, mate.
It's possible WA's wild weather ride could continue. Joining me now from the Bureau of Meteorology is duty forecaster Bob Tarr. Good morning, Bob.
Yeah, good morning.
And so what are we looking at this afternoon?
So we'll just see more showers continuing on and off throughout the day. There was a cold front that passed through the area overnight. And in the wake of that front, we have a pretty cold and unstable air mass moving through the region. So as a result, we will see those on and off showers continuing throughout the day, along with the chance that we could see thunderstorms as the cold pool of air moves through. So it is pretty unstable.
Mm, and there's a lot of wind around at the moment as well. We're seeing trees knocked down all over town.
Yeah, it is fairly windy, especially near coastal parts. And I guess just because of the amount of rain that we've had, probably a lot of the ground is really soft and probably makes it a little bit easier for trees to come down.
Mm. And as this cold front moves in this afternoon, can we expect any hail?
There's a chance that we could see some small hail. It is pretty cold up above the surface, so along with the chance of thunderstorms, there is a chance that we could see some small hail. Probably better chances over southern suburbs where there's a little bit colder, but all through the metro area, there's a possibility of that.
Mm. And when we spoke earlier this week, we talked about the July rainfall record. Are we in danger of crossing that one?
It's possible. The metro area, some of the showers have kind of missed the metro ob site. So we've only received about 7 mils. So we need about another 13 or 14 to surpass the record for that site. If we did get that much, it would be the heaviest rainfall since 1946. But a couple other notable places up in the hills at Bickley, there's been records since 1969. And this is the heaviest rainfall for any month. So going back about a little over 50 years for Bickley, they're up around 450 mils of rain this month. And down at Jandakot, they've had about 300 mils. That's the heaviest rainfall with records dating back to 1971. So it's the heaviest July rainfall and I believe the heaviest rainfall since June of 1983. So even if we don't surpass that record at the metro site, it has been a really, really wet month across the area.
Mm. And we saw the other day that the timing of the storm meant that people doing their sort of afternoon commute home from work was going to be right in the thick of it. Is that going to be the case again today?
Today there's the actual front, what there was of it, passed through overnight. So there's not really going to be too much of a difference from morning to afternoon. Maybe a little bit higher chance this afternoon of a thunderstorm and small hail. But, yeah, otherwise it's just going to be those showers, plenty of showers on the satellite and the radar. So it is just going to be kind of on and off throughout the day.
Mm. Duty forecaster from the Bureau of Meteorology, Bob Tarr. Thanks for being on The West Live.
Sure, no worries.
Well, the highly anticipated McGowan Government Skills Summit kicks off today. Making sure its voice is heard will be the Australian oil and gas industry. Joining me now from APEA, the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, is the WA Director, Claire Wilkinson. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning, Ben.
And so what is the main issue you're hoping to get heard on at this summit?
Well, we're really looking forward to participating today. I think there's no doubt that the industry, the oil and gas industry here in WA, is very committed to employing WA workers and also training WA people for the future. The challenge we do have, however, is that some skills are so highly specialised that they do require years of training and experience. So that's not something we can sort of make happen overnight. And so in the near term, we still need some access to interstate FIFO workers, as many of these specialists tend to live all over Australia. So I guess that's our key message. We're committed to a future of more West Australians working in our industry, but we may need some flexibility in the short term.
Mm. We spoke to the AMWU earlier this week, and they were really pushing the wagon for training up local workers. But as you say, the problem is right now, it's immediate. So how important is it to balance that, though, so we sort of, you know, sort of future-proof that pipeline of skills?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a number of initiatives that we're working on with government. One of them is the LNG Jobs Task Force that the Premier's had in place now for a couple of years. And it's really trying to map out what those skills of the future might be and then ensuring we have those training opportunities in place for people coming through who would like to work in our industry. So, look, it is a balance. But as I said, there are some specialty areas. And if I could name one, it would be maritime skills. They're in particular short supply here in Western Australia. And that will take some years for those people to get the necessary training and experience.
Mm. So when you mention these maritime skills, can you give us an idea of how that impacts the oil and gas industry? How does that create blockages and bottlenecks?
Yeah, so it's actually really critical. So every time you've got an LNG tanker that's coming into port to load LNG to take off to market, you need someone to board that vessel and guide it into the port and ensure that the loading process occurred safely. So there's a number of skill sets involved in that. One would be a marine pilot. You also have load masters that help the product be safely connected and start loading. And you have a surveyor as well to basically assess how much product is going on to the vessel. So that's a bit of a snapshot of some of those skill sets that we're particularly finding we're short of. And of course, if you're not being able to load your vessels and export the product when it's ready to be moved, your tanks soon become full and then you essentially have to shut down your operations. So it's obviously something that all the companies want to avoid. Unfortunately, oil and gas is not a product you can store on a wharf or in a shed for any length of time. It's something that's very dynamic and it's very carefully managed to make sure it's safely produced and then exported when tanks are ready to be emptied.
Mm, I bet. And now we know that Premier Mark McGowan has a real no-risk approach when it comes to managing the pandemic, closes the borders when it looks like there's a chance of any spread from interstate coming into WA. Has that made it harder to bring workers in, looking at the current outbreak in the East Coast? And would you see any reason to ask Premier McGowan to maybe adjust his policy around borders?
I think, we've worked really closely with government throughout the COVID pandemic and we're very grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that because, we do provide essential energy, not just in terms of exports to Southeast Asia or Northern Asia, but to WA itself. A lot of our mines actually run on our natural gas. So, we're critical for many services and undertakings here in WA. I think our workforce is, we don't have a large interstate FIFO workforce. A lot have already moved across. They've been relocated if they could possibly do so last year. And I do think it would be great to be able to have some ability for some very specialist skill sets to continue to be able to move those even when there is a hard border. We would always quarantine them on arrival in WA. That's absolutely a given. And we've been managing that, throughout the pandemic, and it's something that we're very committed to doing going forward, ensuring everyone's safe, both at our work sites, but also in the community.
Mm. And holding a big summit like this is a great thing for politicians to talk about publicly and to show the public that they're serious about an issue and they're taking action about the issue. How confident are you that something tangible for the industry will come out of it?
I think it's a great opportunity for everyone to share their current concerns. And, of course, it's not just about oil and gas or the resources industry more broadly. It's all about tourism, agriculture, the whole hospitality, the whole gamut of industries that are feeling the pinch right now. And I think there probably are some short-term measures that the government can look at to help alleviate some of those skills shortages. It probably will need the support of Commonwealth government as well. So I think it's timely. It's good to have. I think we I'm very hopeful we'll come out with some really workable and useful solutions.
And it's a bit of a question without notice, Claire, but over here in the West, in the West Australia in particular, we've been, I guess, focusing on how women are treated in remote work sites in the resource sector, and that's something that the big miners are really putting an increased focus on addressing. Is that something that the oil and gas industry is similarly aware of and tackling in a very serious way?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, we are very much also focused on this. We'll be making a submission to the WA Parliamentary Inquiry as well. You know, everyone has a right to go to work and feel safe, absolutely, and that is, you know, something that should be a given. And I know our companies are working very hard towards this. I guess there's always things you can do better, and that's what we'll be looking at, I guess, through the inquiry and going forward.
Mm. The Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, WA Director Claire Wilkinson, thanks for your time. We know the summit is kicking off, so we'll let you get in there.
Thanks so much, Ben. Have a good day.
Okay, I don't think we can underestimate how important it is that we fix this skills crisis here in WA, because my hunch is our economic success depends on it. Joining me now from the Chamber of Commerce and Industry WA is Chief Economist Aaron Morey. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Ben.
And so how important, how significant is this summit today?
Oh, look, the summit's an opportunity, Ben, to move forward with the sorts of actions that we need to address this significant skills challenge, as you rightly point out. I mean, I think a key marker for this summit is that we leave with a plan to safely access skilled migration from overseas. Because all the evidence that we've gathered, and including a national survey of 4,000 households conducted by Core Data for us, is that we're really going to struggle to address this challenge through training locals or from attracting people from over east. Yes, those measures can help at the margin, but we're not going to sustainably solve this challenge until we can access skilled migrants coming in to Western Australia.
And so does that suggest then that maybe it's time for state and federal governments to get together and look at how they can address that, how they can potentially tweak the quarantine process and how many people we're letting into Australia to facilitate that?
Well, that's right. And look, there is precedent. There is precedent for bringing people into the country. So the Pacific Labour Scheme has been quite successful, mostly for the agricultural sector, also hospitality to some extent. We look at special events like the Australian Open. These sorts of initiatives can be put in place. Yes, they do require detailed planning. Yes, we must be very careful. You know, obviously restrict them to vaccinated travellers, people coming from safe destinations, and have all the necessary infrastructure in place. But what is clear is that we are not going to solve these challenges until we lean into those opportunities, and the precedent is there, and so we should come up with a plan going forward.
And here's a question for you. So supposing you get those, you know, all your ducks lined up in terms of the processes to bring people into the country, skilled migration back happening again in a safe way, is there going to be a lot of interest in it abroad? Is it going to be such an appealing thing that we're going to be attracting amazing candidates and they're going to be beating down our door to get in here?
My word, they are. I mean, you just need to look through previous booms in Western Australia. I mean, the last mining construction boom, you know, the height of which was sort of between 2010 and 2013, we had about 1,000 international migrants coming to WA per week for a while there. We had absolutely thousands upon thousands of people on local construction sites, up at mines, and working in the hospitality sector, the care sector. We know that when the opportunities are there, that we can access those people. The problem is on our side, and having the necessary infrastructure and the confidence in governments and the community in accepting those people into our great state.
Mm. And how is the economy looking for the next 6 months?
Oh, look, the next 6 months, things are really good. I mean, the next couple of years, I think the Western Australian economy overall looks pretty good. And that's because just about every global commodity market is lining up in Western Australia's favour. We've got a very long pipeline of housing construction, which will take a bit longer than usual, because obviously partly because of these skilled worker shortages. And so we also see significant support that's flowing to those households, and local households have built up their savings, their saving buffers, which will support them into the near-term future. So look, overall things look really good. I mean, the problem is trying to address those skill shortages. Because if we can't, and we get some, you know, obviously breakout wage inflation in places, then we'll see parts of the WA economy really suffer. Last mining construction boom, there are a lot of businesses outside the mining sector that don't look back fondly on that period because they were really crunched in being unable to attract those skilled workers and having to pay exorbitant rates of pay. And so really, if we want a sustainable economy that grows going forward and that can diversify, we need the skilled workers. And that diversification point is really important. I mean, we want to attract the best and brightest people from around the world to help add to our economy and to help diversify it going forward.
Mm. And it would be fair to say that it could really put a handbrake on the economy, and potentially, you know, as the skill shortage worsens, I'm sure the salaries for some of these jobs in the mining sector just only go up and become even more attractive and start really pulling people away from their jobs in Perth.
Well, that's right. I mean, we see a lot of poaching going on, a lot of businesses concerned about not being outbid for workers. I should say we also see it within the mining sector. I mean, the mining sector is a very large, diverse sector in and of itself, there are many businesses within the mining sector that really suffer during this period. Look, and what we're seeing as well is real concerns around reputational damage for businesses. Not just, you know, in mining construction, but also hospitality. So towns like Broome, you know, worried about not providing visitors the experience that they need. And the other important thing to note as well, Ben, is there's the care side of the economy as well. So aged care, disability care. We need thousands upon thousands of people to fill positions in those sectors. Disability, 10,000 alone. So not only, Ben, is this challenge about growing and diversifying the economy, it's about being able to protect our most vulnerable in society.
Yeah, there's so many factors at play here, and let's just hope we get something out of the Skills Summit today. Chamber of Commerce and Industry WA Chief Economist Aaron Morey, always good to chat to you, mate. Thanks for being on the West Live.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, we spoke to the Bureau of Meteorology a little bit earlier. Now let's touch base with DFES and get some more details about the damage caused by this storm front. Joining me now from DFES is Chief Superintendent of Metro Operations, Stuart Wade. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Ben.
And so how many call-outs have you had across the state? What kind of damage have you seen?
From midday yesterday, there's been over 35 requests for assistance to the State Emergency Service. Of which around 24 were for structural damage.
Yeah, right. What were the hardest hit areas?
Around, it was quite broad spread, but Kalamunda, Coogee were some of the notable suburbs. We had a tree falling onto a bedroom roof, causing partial collapse, and we had a large rotten tree breaking into pieces and falling onto a home in Wattle Grove, and part of a roof being blown off in Coogee.
Yeah, wow. The Bureau has warned that there's a chance of thunderstorms and hail in Perth this afternoon. Could that make the situation significantly worse for those who haven't secured their homes after the damage over the last 24 hours?
Well, the ingress of water certainly will make it important that we that's why we're really encouraging people to make sure that they do those checks around their homes, making sure that they tie down those loose items, clean those gutters and trim those overhanging branches.
Yeah, right. And just looking back at this month, there's been almost a record amount of rainfall. We've seen some really incredible scenes of localised flooding, storm damage. How does it stack up to previous winters in your experience?
Probably one of the wettest, for sure, and certainly the continual severe weather warnings, and especially with the wind and the rain combined. I mean, the SES have done over 15, or have received only 1,500 calls since the 1st of June. So it certainly has been a wet and busy winter.
Wow. Well, hopefully there's some respite on the way, but it doesn't look like it. DFES Chief Superintendent of Metro Operations, Stuart Wade. Good luck with everything today. Thanks for squeezing us in. We'll let you get back to it.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's talk Olympics. Joining me now is former Olympian Matt Shervington, part of Channel 7's commentary team at the Games. Good morning, Shervo. How's it all looking for you? You must be pretty pumped right now. You've had to sit through a week of swimmers, and now finally you're going to see some athletes out on the track.
You make it sound like it's torture for the track and field athletes. I know when you're over there, and obviously it's been a little bit different for the athletes because they've had to kind of stagger their entry to the athletes' village this time around. But it is quite hard for the track and field athletes watching on and seeing some of the great performances. But what it really does do is set the tone for the team. And, I mean, we have had such great success, haven't we? In the pool, we saw Jess Fox yesterday. Our rowers have been going extremely well as well. And we've been picking up minor medals in other sports. And Owen Wright in the surfing, that was cool as well. So it just kind of inspires you to do well once day seven hits and the athletic starts.
Yeah, and as an Olympic track and field athlete yourself, like think back to Sydney. When we were doing well in the pool, we were winning gold medals. Does that pump up the whole team, even though it's completely different sporting events?
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think the biggest thing this time around is the fact that, you know, when the rugby league and the AFL had a chance to get back to a truncated season last year during COVID, that was all well and good. But in the back of your mind, you would have to consider that the Olympic athletes weren't able to. So they had their Tokyo Olympics delayed, and they had to go into a semi-lockdown where they weren't able to train fully. They weren't able to travel overseas. And I think that extra year has given them this great amount of gratitude and humility in what they do. And I think they've taken that over to Tokyo with them. And with that comes, you know, obviously a desire to do well, but then also a unity amongst the team. And I think we've really seen that. And the fact that we're doing well on top of all of that creates the best team vibe I think I've seen in Olympic history. I think this team is carried so much happiness into it and fun into it, and I think it's spilled out onto the podium at the same time.
Yeah, and I think across the whole Games, you know, there were some doubts about it going ahead in the pandemic and the situation in Tokyo, but it's been such a pure exhibition of sporting excellence across all of the events that I've seen so far. Is that how you're looking at it?
Yeah, without a doubt, and I think for those... and in New South Wales, we're still in lockdown and we've been restricted. Victoria, the same. Queensland have suffered sort of sporadic lockdowns right across the country, let's be honest. And I think it just brings a distraction to a time when you need something to take you away and say, hey, look, this is happening around the world. Aren't we amazing? Aren't the representatives for our country wearing the green and gold representing us doing so well, and not just doing it well from a performance level, but from an emotional level, from a humble level, and they're just such great ambassadors for us. So I'm so impressed and so happy to have them there for us, and it's uplifting. And I think, you know, when we're going through a time of uncertainty, it's given us something to really focus on. And I think those athletes, you know, in Tokyo that have done well have they've lifted spirits, and I think there are a lot of people struggling, and I think that they may have even, you know, brought them out of a hole. So I mean, that's a huge responsibility, and I think they've done a great job of it.
Shervo, I'm going to get you to talk about your pet subject in just a second, but before I do, you like hearing you talking about that, you know, sort of people finding themselves in a bit of a dark place. One of the big talking points of this Olympics, of course, has been Simone Biles in the women's gymnastics. As someone who's competed at the elite level of their sport yourself, who knows a thing or two about carrying expectations into a big international meet, how did you feel when you saw her press conference, when you saw her decision to withdraw? Like, what sort of feelings is that generating in you?
I'll give you a little analogy that I kind of kept coming back to when I was competing, and it's that analogy of climbing Everest. And if the Olympic gold is the peak of your Everest, your sporting Everest. I mean, Simone Biles has reached that level. But when you start out in your career, you pack your bag to go up for the ascent. And when you actually get up the top, you have this realization that you can't be there forever. at some point you're going to have to strategize as to how to come down. And, you know, if you actually do climb Mount Everest, you've got to pack your bag for on the way up and the way down. And the oxygen runs out once you're up the top, and you start to realize that you could be in trouble if you haven't packed your bag full of oxygen. So you look in your kit bag at the top, and all of a sudden you think, hang on, I'm not equipped for this. And I think Simone obviously has been at the top for so long. She was unbeaten since 2013. We know what she did in Rio. She was up for 6 gold medals at these games. The expectation has been building for an extra year for her. And then I think the realization for her in the qualifying of the all-around team event, she made a couple of mistakes and then realized, I might not be able to execute this perfectly. And I think the weight of that expectation, as you mentioned, becomes extremely forefront. And you have to not just deal with it over a period of time, but you've literally got hours and days to figure it out, how to readdress it. The other side of it is she never competes without her family in the crowd. And this is the first time so many athletes have done that. So there are so many elements to it. But, I mean, what a brave move to pull out of a team's event during the event and say that I can't handle this, guys. I'm struggling.
Mm, yeah, she went from feeling like she had to climb Mount Everest to feeling like she had to carry Mount Everest, which is a massive, massive burden. And now, Shervo, for many years, you were Australia's fastest man. How are you predicting the current fastest man in Australia is going to go in Tokyo?
Yeah. I reckon he can make the final. Rowan Browning, you're talking about. So
yeah.
Rowan, just for those that don't know, he has he wouldn't be in Tokyo if it was on last year. Put it that way. He was carrying an injury into his preparation. He had missed the qualifying time. But I think the extra year's given him a real inspiration to get better, and he's done that. He's done an extremely good job of that. He ran 10.05 earlier in the year. He's run 10.08, 10.09. He's consistently around that time. To qualify in Rio for the final was 10.01, 10.02 in London. And don't forget, there's no Usain Bolt now. I don't believe that the 100-metre lineup is as competitive as it has been in previous games. I think he's a real chance to make the final if he does that. It'll be the first male to make the 100-metre final since 1956.
Wow.
So that in itself would just be a phenomenal effort. But I think he can go sub-10, Rowan.
Really?
And if it's great conditions and fast track, yeah, watch out.
Well, that would be incredible. That would be something special to see. Like you mentioned Usain Bolt, he's not there. Who are the big challenges in the 100, which is, you know, the blue ribbon event of the track and field program?
Yeah, well, as I said, like it's open to a certain extent, but there's probably the standout favourite at the moment. 9.77 he's run this year is Trayvon Bromell. He won the Olympic trials. In saying that, though, he got beaten in his last start only mid-July by another American, Ronnie Baker. Fred Curley from the US as well has qualified. Akini Zimbini is a great competitor from South Africa that's very experienced and knows what to do in this environment. He'll handle the no crowd, the extra delay, all of that probably better than anyone. Adam Jamili from Great Britain is a chance. But fundamentally, I mean, I don't think we're going to see a Usain-style winner at these games in the 100. In saying that, though, keep an eye out for a young kid in the 200 metres, because I think if it's not these games, it'll be Paris or LA. A kid called Arian Knighton, who is 17 years of age. He scraped in the trials to come third and qualify in the 200. He has already run faster than Usain Bolt at the same age over the 200. So he could be a megastar if he keeps progressing the way he's going.
Yeah, that's a good tip, one to watch. And how much do sprinters feed off that crowd energy when you're coming up to the blocks and, you know, you've got 60,000 people all screaming and all watching? Because it's such a short race.
A lot. And I think there's two sides to a sprinter. They come across as hugely egotistical and confident, but in actual fact, they need everything to go right. And I think there will be a lot of they're performers, they're show-offs, a lot of them. So they need an audience. And I think a lot of them, they'll find it hard. And that's why I think Rowan will go well, because he doesn't. He's very focused. He knows the process of his race very well and has been executing that beautifully in the last few months. So I think he'll really benefit. I think the athletes that can focus will do extremely well. I remember Carl Lewis said something to me once when I asked him, what do you do when the conditions aren't great? When it's raining, when it's cold, if there's a headwind? He said, I visualize my lane, no matter what everyone else's lane is doing, as dry, sunny, and perfect. And if I can do that, no matter what the conditions, I'll run well. So if you can tap into that, I think whoever it is will do well.
You know, that's good advice for life, really, if you think about it, I think. And now, normally with the Olympics, the first week, the swimming, we do pretty well. This time we've done very well. It tends to dry up a little bit in terms of podium finishes in the second week. Where can you see some potential golds for Australia emerging?
I think we'll do better than we have at previous Olympics in this second week, especially on the track. The track's been kind of slim pickings outside of Sally Pearson, Kathy Freeman in past games. But we have a number of national record holders that have come into these Olympic Games performing better than they ever have. The first one is a guy called Stu McSwain, who over the 1500 metres is the first Australian to break 3 minutes 30. And that's, if he can do that, he'll put himself in the mix for a medal. But the 1500 metres notoriously at the Olympic Games is all about strategy. And what it allows Stu to do is to know that he's got a bit of speed up his sleeve and to be able to go with whatever tactics are used in the race. And I think that'll put him in a really, really good position to snag a medal. And just imagine that. I mean, the 1500 metres really is the longest standing legacy for Australian success at the Olympics. Edwin Flack, all the way back in 1896, won Australia's first gold. 1500 metres. I mean, it would just the synergy would be amazing. Outside of that, Nicola McDermott in the high jump, she is a real chance. So she's the first ever female Australian to break the 2 metre mark in the high jump. She did it at the trials. She's also jumped 201 at a meet early in July in Europe. So she's a real chance for a medal if she jumps that sort of distance. Nina Kennedy, I love Nina Kennedy from WA. She is just the perfect package. She's just a lovely girl. She is hugely confident, broke a world junior record back in 2015. She broke the Australian record earlier this year with 4 metres 82. And if she can jump around that, she'll be jumping for medals.
Yeah, fantastic. And we love to hear Aussies who are rounding into form when the Olympics come along. Matt Shervington, Olympian himself, and a real important part of Channel 7's coverage of the track and field over the next week or so. It's such a treat to have you on the West Live today. Hopefully we can get you on again before the Olympics finish.
Yeah, 100%. Love to join you again. Thank you.
Fearless Friday with Jeff Parry.
He's back in the studio after a couple of weeks of sick leave. You're crook.
I was sick, yes. It was just one of these massive man colds that we get.
Yeah, there's a bad case of it going around this year. Don't diminish it. People are getting really, really sick.
Well, my colleague Jessica Page has had it twice. We think we've been infecting each other in the office. I mean, we've been wearing masks and all that sort of stuff. And it's just really, it's one of those ones you just got to take yourself home and let it run its course. But yeah, I had a few days off and tried to get back to work, and then I just had to leave for a while. And
had you had the flu vaccine?
I had the flu vaccine. Yeah, so it was only a cold. I mean, you know, it was a bit rough, and probably rougher than a normal cold is. But and that's not saying I've got man flu or anything. So had a COVID test, which you normally do.
I was talking to an expert yesterday, off the record, who said that the flu vaccine's, you know, maybe certainly not the same level of efficacy as we're seeing from the COVID vaccine.
No. I mean, I don't think it was the flu. I had flu last year. Really had a shocking dose of it. I had a COVID test, and it actually came back and told me what strain of flu it was. So, anyway, I mean, it's going around, and as you say, I mean, I think it's just probably a bit meaner this time. Maybe people are a bit more run down. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you survived. That's the important thing. Did it give you a chance to watch some of the Olympics?
Yeah, probably more than I was expecting. I've been back at work all of this week, so we've got, you know, massive screens around the office.
You can't miss it.
Across the other side of this floor. And I got one sitting just above my desk. So, and because the timing's fantastic, you know, for our part of the world. So, you know, I saw all the rowing gold, Jessica Fox, you know,
How great was that?
Loss and eventual win. She cried both times. Yep. I mean, what a roller coaster. Got to make up her mind. but good on her. She's fantastic. And all the other, the other ones that are sort of come and gone. It's just on. I'm not massive sports fan. I'm still conflicted. I don't know why skateboarding is in the Olympics. And of course now children can win gold medals. I mean, what a great thing for when you go back to school. Oh, what did you do for show and tell? I've got a gold medal.
Exactly. How do you spend your school holidays?
Man, really?
Aren't there kids doing gymnastics as well?
Oh, well, there are. Yeah, I suppose there are. Yeah, but this, there are. But I mean, other sort of sports like, tennis, should that really be their goal? People who hold these views.
Well, surfing is an interesting one, because I've spoken to plenty of surfers who you'd think, how stoked are they that their sport's getting recognised? They say the opposite. They say because every surf event on the World Surfing Tour is picked based on where the waves are good, whereas the Olympics. That's a side issue.
You take what you get.
And what happens if you're playing in the Olympics in a country that's landlocked in the middle of Europe?
I don't know what you do. I have a disposal.
Wave park, maybe.
Wherever. But, some of these sports... I've always had this theory that the Olympics are sort of... that grew out of, like Greece where, it was all military. You'd run to Sparta, so they had, marathon.
Throw a spear.
Throw a spear. Got archery. You ride your horses and all that sort of stuff. And so, no one ever turned up to war with a tennis racket or a golf stick.
Didn't they compete in the nude as well?
I don't think it's going to return to that somehow. But yes, I'm assuming they did. I mean, even to like... They actually got rid of it. Horse polo, so where they'd bat around the infidels' heads with a stick, out on the open field. I mean, they knocked that on the head back in 1936, apparently.
Yeah, right.
So, it was because the popularity of the sport diminished, and you can get golf, people make a.
I haven't watched any of the golf. I've got to be honest with you. I've had zero interest in the golf.
Oh no, I'm the same.
And the tennis as well. Not that I like watching tennis, but for whatever reason, I just can't get into it in the Olympics.
I like my favourite sports. I mean, swimming's always good
What's
to watch.
What's been the sport that surprised you?
10-metre air pistol. and because the technology these days, it doesn't actually... I know you watch them and they put a pellet in the air pistol and then you've got a split screen and you've got the target and then... But it looks like it's... electronically generated where the target, where it hits the target. You don't actually see it penetrating the target. And, I mean, it's just like, it's a bit mindless, really. You just sort of load it up, single shot, air pistol, bang.
And they're so accurate, right?
They're so accurate. It's like an 8-1 and then there's an 8-3 and it looks like it's in the same spot on the thing, but it's, it's something, how is that a 9-2?
You become addicted to it, I can tell.
And with the rifles, the air rifles, that just looks odd.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, no, it is
awkward.
Weird.
But I like the archery, I like those sorts of sports.
Been good.
Weightlifting, I really like. I just think it's the skill in that.
Did you see the Filipino female lifter win the first gold for that country?
Yeah, 96 kilos or something. Right?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, I mean, there's something there for everyone, isn't there, Ben?
Sure is. And with 45 channels to choose from across the various Channel 7 platforms,
there literally is. Yeah, and you know what I like? Well, of course, you just multi-channels everywhere and you go online and pick your sport
almost
and you can watch.
Almost too many, if I'm being honest. I find myself, it's a bit like Netflix, Like you start watching something and after a couple of minutes you go, I'm not sure if I'm actually into skeet shooting. Maybe I'm going to give K1 a go. It's like, K1, maybe it's not as interesting as I thought.
I did like what Matt Shervington said about, the performances of these athletes in this time of the pandemic and the way, where everyone is in the world and that sort of thing, that how uplifting it's been for a lot of people because more uplifting than performance of our politicians. I mean, we've got to look somewhere, so let's look to our athletes because they're actually doing something, pretty special.
Definitely.
And while it's only for, two or three, 2.5 weeks of the year or every 4 years, I mean, we're getting something out of them. Polly's not so sure.
Do you know what the coverage highlights for me? So talking about, like this idea of Netflix and, the difference between that and broadcast television, right? Like really sums up where society is at the moment. Like you've got this unlimited choice. People seem to want to gravitate towards that, whether it's Netflix or Spotify or whatever, like they want to be their own boss. Do it when they want to do it. Watch what they want to watch. They don't want to be told by, a programmer or, someone who does schedules of TV or whatever. But I tell you, there is something to be said for that, to know that there is someone who's looking across all of the events going, okay, this one is going to be the most exciting, this one is going to have the best result, and then you're getting that kind of curated version so you don't miss anything, you don't miss the best bits. I miss so many like gold medal moments because I've been flicking between the 45 channels.
But the other thing too is, and this is where it's come along, is that you remember, you know, like you go back 3 or 4 Olympics when there were limited channels that you could actually broadcast on. So you'd miss a lot, not just missing because you're looking at something else, it's because you never saw them.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know,
there's niche events.
That's correct. But also for some of the bigger events like swimming, the Australians would sort of, you know, we'd concentrate ours. The Americans were notorious. I mean, they wouldn't care about an Australian gold medal. All they cared about was the, you know, so they would NBC would concentrate on their stuff. Now, they, you know, it just comes in these massive feeds and they send it out on, you know, on all their channels. I mean, you know, the channels of seven, you know, like are 107. They're just channels. It's just like massive, massive, you know, and it's fantastic.
And the ratings have been great because most of the East Coast is in lockdown. And so I can give you right now the latest news from New South Wales. They've just announced they had 170 new cases today. So that's less than yesterday's 239 odd, which is positive, I guess. At least 42 were infectious in the community, but it could have been as many as 90 infectious in the community.
I'm waiting to see what comes out of this protest they had, you know, when they had 15,000 marching down George Street in Sydney. When those numbers might hit, if they're going to hit at all. I mean, you know,
all it would have taken is one or two people in that crowd to have the Delta variant.
Yeah, and then they've not just gone back, you know, to the southwest. They've gone to the northwest. They've gone to the northern suburbs. They've gone to the Southern Shire, you know, they've gone everywhere and taken it with them. So not sure when those numbers, if they've predicted when those numbers might come into it, if they do, they don't.
Well, I spoke to a couple of medical experts yesterday. They weren't epidemiologists, but, you know,
everyone's an epidemiologist
But they were, you know, they were health professionals. One said he didn't think that New South Wales would get on top of it. He thought the horse had bolted and now they're always going to have COVID in their community. And the other one said not before Christmas. So both pretty grim predictions.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, you know, and the political fallout for Gladys and for the Prime Minister, you know, they're being watched, you know, sort of by the minute, aren't they, for their reactions and their different reactions. And I mean, you talk to most people over here and they just sort of, they're incredulous at what they call a lockdown or, you know, a full lockdown in New South Wales. I mean, it's just, there's lockdowns in part of Sydney, but it's not a lockdown like we know it, or it's not a lockdown like Victorians know it, or even South Australians, you know. I mean, it's a lockdown as a full crack at it, whereas they seem to think in New South Wales that you know, what they're doing is a full lockdown.
It's a mockdown.
Yeah, it's not. It is a mockdown. It's certainly not a lockdown. And now, of course, Mr. Morrison's an absolute champion of lockdown, where before he wasn't, you know, so.
How much has all of this, do you reckon, impacted ScoMo, and how much will it hurt him at the ballot box? Because he's thrown his lot in with Gladys, famously, over and over again, and now it seems that he's walking back that support a little bit.
Well, the results, I was reading Mark Riley's column in the West Australian today, how Morrison was making a point continuously that he wasn't criticising Gladys Berejiklian. No one was accepting that. He was certainly criticising because he was so in the corner about no lockdowns, and now he's in the corner of, well, we've got to have a full lockdown. It's hurt him. It's certainly hurt him in the opinion polls. They are very sensitive to that. He cannot shake that he's a reactive politician. He's just going to go whichever way the wind blows.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because
he's not alone among politicians.
No, that's true. But he just, you know, obviously in the hope that it'll blow him over the line. So, but he's certainly struggling in the respect stakes in terms of how he's handled this. And he has to get on top of that before the next election.
Well, he said that everyone in Australia who wants the vaccine will be vaccinated by the end of the year. The Grattan Institute has come out with some modelling that said they reckon 80% could be vaccinated by next March. If you say the Grattan, you know, if you bank on their numbers, that's, you know, next March is getting pretty close to when a federal election might be. That would be a pretty bad result for Scott Morrison.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, he just has to get on top of it. I mean, you know, mistakes aren't sort of, I mean, we had a recent mistake where everyone just scratching their head here in WA. I mean, the second lift incident should never have happened, but they put that down to you know, technology and that the program on the lift failed. Worse than that is the fact that they were two unvaccinated health workers. I mean, you know, for crying out loud, why? I mean, I understand mistakes happen. You know, there's always little things that fall through the cracks, but you just can't help scratching your head because I think now they're saying what, 1 in 5 frontline health workers aren't vaccinated.
Yeah.
How is that allowed to happen?
Yeah, I know. I know. And this goes back to, you know, Atagi's initial advice was that it shouldn't be mandatory for health workers. And they initially said it also shouldn't be mandatory for aged care workers. And then that was overruled by the Morrison government and said, no, it's going to be mandatory for aged care. Surely we're at that point where it's got to be, at the very least, in hospitals where they treat people with COVID.
Because doesn't common sense just dictate that should be the case?
I know.
And I just also can't understand the hesitancy of some medical workers who should know better.
Yeah.
That they don't get vaccinated, and I mean, just take your body off to a you know, we should be vaccinated in the hospital. Well, okay, if you're not, then go to a vaccination centre and get one.
Yeah.
You know, ridiculous. I mean, take a bit of responsibility.
And I think people don't realise, I guess, just how tough it is for Morrison now. So on one hand, you know, if he doesn't kind of offer some sort of a rebuke of Gladys, the rest of the country thinks he's an idiot. And so that hurts his popularity with the rest of the country. If he bags Gladys too much, that'll hurt him in New South Wales. And so he needs New South Wales to vote for him. He needs the rest of the country to vote for him if he's going to...
Well, that's his home state. He needs to perform in his home state. But, you know, he's Victoria seemed to be very happy with the way Dan Andrews has reacted. Certainly, Mark McGowan here is still very popular for the way that he's reacted. And I mean, it is, I think everyone would accept, it's easier for him because it's much easier to close down our state. We don't have sort of these massive borders. And if you don't let anyone in, well, you know, now they're just coming in by ship. But, you know, the other, Queensland, of course, has big border with New South Wales, and so does Victoria. It's a much bigger effort for them to keep the disease out, even if they lock themselves down. And because a lot of the problems of people like the removalists who got off lightly, I think, all these people who try and do border runs and are able to get through sometimes and take the disease into, you know, up to the Gold Coast or whatever they've done, you know, so it's much easier for McGowan, but he's very, very popular for the stance that he's taken. Morrison, it just seems to have mangled it.
Well, based on what we've seen from McGowan so far this pandemic, if you had to predict how low the case numbers had to get in New South Wales every day for McGowan to even partially reopen the border, what would you reckon?
That he would do?
Yeah.
Oh, he will want zero.
Zero. So do you know how long it's going to take for Sydney to get to zero?
Yeah.
He's erasing a huge part of the country from Western Australia.
But, you know, having said that, I mean, it'll certainly take a mind shift for the WA government, the health authorities here. But, you know, everyone's talking about the vaccines is going to be the saviour of all this. Once we get the vaccines, you know, up to whatever it is, 80% or whatever they're going to nominate next week, whatever that number is, and that will allow us to live with COVID in the community. But you know, our health authorities here in WA have to be willing for COVID to be circulating around the community, which will cause people to get sick and go into hospitals. The saving grace, we think, is that, or everyone thinks, the medical people think that you know, the effect of the disease back, you know, when we've got herd immunity will be much less than, you know, with unvaccinated population.
Yeah, so many unknowns
but,
there.
But, yeah, and we've got no real guidance from. I mean, the premier says the vaccines will save us all, like all the other premiers say, but that means he's also going to.
We've only got 60% of health workers vaccinated.
That's right, but it also means he has to accept that the virus will be circulating in the community as well.
Yeah. Well, are you going to hang around for the Wild West with that, Richards?
I wouldn't miss it.
The Wild West. Joining me now in the studio, as she does every day on this wild and wet Friday, is Perth Now editor Nat Richards. G'day, Nat.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Hi, Nat.
Hiya, how are you, Jeff?
Now, just further to your last point about herd immunity, Jeff. So I was reading this in the news yesterday, Nat. So the UK, right, they reckon now they're on the cusp of achieving herd immunity.
Well, that's not proven by the numbers, is it?
Well, they reckon that it's getting to the point where the disease is not very serious. And some experts, some health experts
are saying... Fewer hospitalisations.
Yeah. And they say that the Euros, which everyone thought was a bad idea, actually has probably pushed it over the edge towards herd immunity because so many people caught COVID. There's now something, it's something crazy, like 89% of adults in the UK have COVID antibodies.
Can I ask how your brother is?
He's fine, but he says his throat is still groggy. He says he don't know whether he's ever going to be able to shake that. He says he's still got that tickle in his throat.
Right.
And he did say that somebody he knew as well had lost their hearing in one ear, who'd also had it, and it hadn't come back. So,
Is he able to go to pub?
He is able to go to a pub. He wouldn't miss going to a pub, I'm sure.
And now, Jeffrey, do you watch Farmer Wants a Wife?
Of course he does. It's on Channel 7.
No, I don't really. I've seen little glimpses of it. I watched a bit of the last series.
Oh, you're in for a treat here with this next story. Can you give Jeffrey a bit of a
catch-up? We'll give you a quick rundown. So, Farmer Wants a Wife, right? You know what the idea behind it is. So, they have farmers dotted around the country. They're single. They go and stick some women in with them. They all fight over him and eventually picks one. And hopefully he marries her and has kids and they all live happily ever after. Now, there's one farmer who had his group of women. Another farmer had his group of women. And anyway, got to Farmer Matt got to the Will. Sorry, got to the end of his group of women, and Farmer Will decided that he didn't have anybody that he wanted to stay with long term. Farmer Matt has gone and ditched this particular woman called Hayley, and she's been left as a single,
distraught.
So do you know what she decides to do? She says, right, let's send some text to Farmer Will. He's single right now. So she's shacked up with Farmer Will, got pregnant to him. Get this. And then, so by the time we found out about the pregnancy over here, they've split. So now she's managed to get pregnant to another farmer. It's a bombshell. When it comes to Farmer Wants a Wife, that's about as scandalous as it gets.
So who's the father? Farmer Will?
Farmer Will. Not the farmer that she was after. She was after Farmer Matt.
So it's turned out the farmer didn't want a wife. He just wanted a quick shag.
Yeah, well, was it Farmer Andy? Who punted? It was one of the farmers punted all his women 3 weeks ago or something or other.
Yeah.
So what happened?
They get rid of people. I tell you what, they're brutal when it comes to choosing the women. Farmers.
So if the premise is that you got a farmer and you've got a woman who wants to be his wife, and then suddenly farmer says, "Nope, don't want any of you," and punts them, and he's got no wife. He's a bit like.
Maybe there's a reason he's been single for so long.
Yeah, well said.
But does he get to stay on the show because he's got no, he's got no women?
They decide at the end, right?
So you go, I might let somebody back in. Maybe she can have another chance. Okay.
They ever have intruders, bringing new people?
They go in, like Big Brother, they've gone drop an intruder in.
And so what's the latest bombshell in this story?
The latest in this is that all we can do now is watch social media and watch how this plays out. And so Farmer Will has turned comments off on his Instagram, which says it all. He's copied a massive backlash by the sounds of it.
For dumping the woman that he's impregnated.
Yeah,
so he dumped her?
Yeah, he's dumped a pregnant woman. She says
didn't walk out. He's dumped her.
They're split.
Yeah.
But it's not reflected well on him, right? It's always his fault, And so, he's copping a massive backlash. He's turned off comments because he's probably I've had enough of this. Now he started sharing pictures of the other women, the women that he didn't end up with, on his Instagram. Like, what's all that about? It's like he's taunting her. What's that about?
Pictures with him and
selfies of the women.
Oh, so he's like reposting that.
And saying how they make him laugh and all this.
Mm.
So what's that about? What is that about? No acknowledgement of this baby. It's all a bit bizarre to me, this. And, she's there, growing bump and baby growing inside her.
Hang on.
And he's nowhere to be seen.
Hang on. The show only ran for about... only runs for about 15 weeks.
It only takes once, Jeff.
No, I know that. But you can't grow a lot. You can't sort of just... be with one farmer
It takes a while for, these things to go on TV and everything. And by which
television.
Point she shacked up. Him and her shacked up. And, yeah. We've got a farmer wants a wife baby that we did not expect.
This is very un-farmer wants a wife-ish. This is more like Married at First Sight-ish.
It's the most wholesome TV show.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of the ones that's got the best success rate in terms of long-term
And now we've
partners.
Got six out of wedlock.
I know. Mm. Shocking.
Maybe. Can you imagine? Tongues would be wagging in those little country towns where the farmer lives.
Oh, I'm living for this story.
The formats have to grow, though, don't they? You know, from season to season. They've sort of got to expand. You know, like Big Brother's gone to places Big Brother never went before.
Well, yeah. Do you remember the very first Big Brother?
I remember
watching that, and that was the best one because they had no idea that it was so big on the outside.
They just
thought, oh, I'm doing this in the hope I can win some cash.
Yeah.
And there were no influencers in it there those
days.
Yeah.
It was totally changed reality.
It was
TV.
So good.
Who was the? I think she was a Bunbury girl. Anne Marie
was.
Yeah, was she a Perth girl? Wasn't she? She became.
And Nathan from Nova
was massive.
Was he in the first year of Big Brother? Yeah.
Yeah, well, when I say the first one, I mean the British one, of course, which probably you guys didn't see over here.
The rise of the influencers has made all reality TV a bit tougher now because there's a lot of attention seekers.
They know they're going that house. They know they're going to get the promotion.
They're going to get huge followers on Instagram. And now let's cross to a Perth council, which this reminds me of a story that you brought to me ages ago about a petition to ban those
fire pits
at Bunnings. Yeah. Is this what this is about?
No, this is about wood heaters inside your house. So the City of Netherlands, a particular councillor, has brought this to the table. He said, I'd like us to look at outlawing wood heaters inside your home.
On what grounds?
Because he's asthmatic. And he says, I'm asthmatic, so nobody else can have one. But the idea is, you know, he says, other people are asthmatic out there. This causes a lot of problems for people. Let's look at perhaps in the long term getting rid in our council. Now, first of all, I don't think they even can do that. I think they have to work with the state government to make that a thing.
Yeah.
I don't think they can just decide that they're not having that anymore. But it's an interesting debate, isn't it? I mean, can you see any council getting rid of wood burners in winter? It's such an Australian wholesome thing.
You wouldn't have any problem in Ellenbrook. They probably don't even have any in like the newer housing
suburbs.
Yeah,
or maybe gas heaters.
In Netherlands, you know.
Well, yeah, they all went in the 70s.
Yeah.
And they're all, you know, I mean, no one. Show me someone who puts a wood heater in their house.
I want
now.
One for my house.
Do you?
Yeah, oh, I think they're great.
What I will say is I can.
Do you live in Netherlands?
I do not live in Netherlands. I'm not that fancy, Jeff. Steady on.
I can kind of sympathise with this councillor a little bit because I'm asthmatic as well. And, you know, I definitely notice when I go for a run in the morning, back when that was something that happened, the smoke from everybody's fireplaces is kind of thick in the air.
Oh, I love the. I mean, I yearn for the old days when you could rake your leaves into a pile in the backyard and set fire to them.
Can't you still do that?
No.
So especially, maybe not so much in the city over here, but I think especially when I go down south, you go to country areas and you've got that the log burner in your living room or whatever, and you're sitting there with a glass of wine. There's nothing like it. And a lot of people in the UK where I come from, I mean, granted, I come from Yorkshire, which is pretty much the countryside compared to London, and people are putting in log burners because there's just because of that nostalgia and that nice home warm.
Yeah,
homely,
I'm
warm country feeling.
I do like that as well. So what are you guys up to this weekend?
A bit of grandchildren time this weekend, I think. Yes. Working Sunday.
Lovely. I'm renovating our laundry this weekend and then I'm going to the Dockers game on Sunday.
Oh,
yeah, how about you, Ben?
So I'll be cleaning up around the yard from the storms. And what else? I'm overdue to, this is very boring, I'm overdue to do a whole bunch of like winter pruning that you're supposed to do in your garden, you know, so it grows back for spring.
Oh, that's careful with those clippers, Ben.
I hear about it, but you lose fingers.
Because I've got these hibiscus, which are lovely, but I have left it too long and now they're just kind of like spindly sticks with a little flower on the end. They don't look great. So I'm going to try and cut them back, see if I can salvage something there.
It'd be best looking garden in the northern suburbs, eh, Ben?
Then rake them into a pile in the backyard and set fire.
Yes.
I'll invite you around, Jeffrey. Well, thanks, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Cheers, mate.
Well, that's it from me this week. Massive thanks to my producers who help get the show out every day. And you can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live online. And of course, if you're loving the games, be sure to download Let's Go Tokyo with myself and Mark Reddings. We'll keep you across everything Olympics, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Catch you next week.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.